I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurta, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
I'm Dana Slater. Welcome to our 25th Origins installment. We're really thrilled tonight. We have a really fun one, I think, in hand. We have all this good stuff up here to talk about. We're going to talk about foraging, mushrooms, truffles, ramps, ferns, berries, mulberries, et cetera, et cetera. I always do a little research before these events, and I found an article in the 2011, it was a 2011 New Yorker article by Jane Kramer, and I'm just going to read this. It said, "For centuries, foraged food was a sign of poverty, and they called it famine food or animal food. The exception was truffles and porcini, which today command enough money for a good forager to be able to wait in line at the supermarket buying stale food with bourgeoisie. Some of my neighbors have truffle hounds penned in front of their chicken coops, ostensibly keeping foxes at bay, but they never ask to truffle in the woods by my pond when I'm around, and by local etiquette, they would have to offer some of the precious tubers they unearthed to me. They wait until September when I'm back in New York and keep all of the truffles for themselves." So with that, I just want to introduce our esteemed panelists tonight. Jeff Long has been an amateur mycologist for 30 years. He's been foraging mushrooms for 30 years and truffle hunting for about 8 years now. He is past president of the Mycological Association of Washington, D.C., and is currently the only living lifetime honorary member of that organization. Jeff also lectures and speaks about mushrooms and truffles at least a couple of times a year, and we're grateful that one of them is tonight. Welcome, Jeff. Tom, over here. Tom, is it Mueller or Mueller?
Mueller.
Mueller. Is a wild edibles forager, CIA-trained chef, and co-owner of a catering company for 25 years, focusing on local and organic ingredients before it was in vogue. A lifetime of enjoying nature, Tom started foraging for mushrooms in the late 1980s and began providing the mushrooms to restaurants in 2012. Tom has been foraging full-time since 2017, focusing on 65 varieties of mushrooms and wild edibles, including ramps, wild asparagus, and spice bush berries. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
Just a couple of quick notes. As always, there's a fantastic team to thank for tonight's event, with special thanks to Spike for taking time to host and facilitate our discussions. Big thanks to Hannah Reagan over there, always leading with a steady hand. Thank you to Lauren.
Go ahead.
Clap. thank you to Lauren Paven-Jones, who's not here tonight, and her amazing crew here at Artifact Coffee. Special thanks to Yolanta for doing our flowers tonight. And I'm grateful to Mary Romeo. Where's Mary? Mary Romeo's work on our Facebook page, Donnie Carlo, who's doing the recording tonight. And, of course, Chef Lou and his team in the kitchen, who are going to provide us with an incredible foraged dinner. So for those of you that are new to Origins, just a couple of little housekeeping items. We do record tonight's proceedings, and everything is then uploaded as a podcast to Heritage Radio, which is a streaming radio station in Brooklyn. So if you'd like to speak, if you could kindly just raise your hand, and I'll bring over the mic to you, and just try to recognize that it just helps with the sound quality. So I think without further ado, I'll turn it over to Spike.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this conversation with these two guys for so long, and they spend so much time out in the woods. I know that they have a lot to say because it all gets pent up and
a lot of thinking going on.
Yes, indeed. But you know, first, every time I talk to a farmer, I'm reminded of how much they know, and it reminds me that I'm not a farmer. And similarly, I think when I talk to Jeff and Tom, I'm reminded that I, as much as I love it and as much as I appreciate what they do, I'm not a forager. There is an incredible wealth of information that's at this table tonight that I'm just so excited to kind of tap into a little bit. But first, can you remind me of how we met?
Sure. So a friend actually contacted either you or Opie because he had chanterelles. And I brought those chanterelles. And I think that was 2 years ago when we were sitting. You were actually sitting in the restaurant. I delivered around 2 o'clock. And I had chanterelles in 3 different containers, one from Charles County, one from, I think, Prince George's, and one from Garrett County.
Uh-huh.
And I could tell that I felt a connection right away. So, and the other thing that was fantastic, and this gets back to what makes it just great for us as foragers, you basically said, bring me $200 worth of mushrooms a week. And no one's ever done that, you know. And not that we could always do that because it's based on when they're growing. But very honestly, this is a kind of customer that we need that understands. You know, you'll call a chef and they'll tell you, well, I can't use that this week. Call me next week. They don't get the idea of what is a foraged item.
Right. Well, we're so connected to the seasons and to the, you know, to the kind of the vagaries of agriculture that it's probably not as much of a stretch for us as it might be for others. But I want to go back a little bit, and we've got a lot to talk about, and you know, I kind of met Jeff through Tom, so we'll get to eventually that part of that story. But let's just talk about, before we kind of get into some of the cool details, the nitty-gritty, you know, let's talk about what foraging really is, because I think it has this very interesting kind of term. It's kind of had a moment in the press for a little while. Foraging, there are restaurants, you know, around the globe that are kind of known for that. I'm not quite sure what I think about that, but you know, let's talk about what foraging is. And to me, it seems like, you know, with everything that's been written about it, it can feel a little bit kind of like this specialized thing. But actually, like when I used to go out picking berries with my dad, I was probably foraging, right?
Absolutely.
On some level,
yeah,
we were picking wine berries around. And but tell me what it means to you, because you guys are the best example of.
You know, foraging to me, and so just as a quick background, running a catering business with Nancy, you know, I did a lot of driving, looking for pork, looking for this ingredient, the other ingredient. I wouldn't just order it in from Sysco or a wholesaler. And so that kind of opened up the idea of, well, geez, can I go further down the line? In other words, instead of buying, you know, asparagus that has been grown in a field that somebody took the time and planted and grew and harvested and sold me, can I find it in the woods? Can I find it native or wild? And so I think that, you know, so to me, the foraging as a chef and being in the food business is more about going deeper in, not just finding things that I am aware of or have learned, a specific mushroom, a morel. And I started with morels. Many people, when you start a conversation about mushrooms, it's frequently the morel. And if they're from Michigan or you know, these parts of the country, you know that's the morel and that's their focus. And for many years, that's all I did. I collected morels and I went back to work. I never sold a mushroom until 2012. But I think that it's that idea of just getting it, the lure of trying to find it. But then there's a lot of background you need as well in terms of, well, if I look at the forest, the trees over here, I'm seeing tulip poplar, what does that tell me that I potentially will find there? So it's also the knowledge of what is a tree telling me? What should I find there? But then moving further into plants and other wild edibles, that's where I rely on frequently the restaurant or chef. And both at A Rake's Progress and Woodbury Kitchen, I love that when someone says to me, a chef asks, can you get this? Can we get yarrow? Can we get, you know, and so that expands my vocabulary of, is it even available? Is it native? Is it invasive? When it's invasive, it's even better because now when I harvest an invasive, that is not going to become a seed and make a further plant. So was the original question, what is foraging?
a little bit. Maybe what is it to you? Or maybe, you know, and now that, and maybe as a chef, it's kind of like, maybe why bother? I mean, you can pick up the phone. Any chef can pick up the phone or get online and order anything from any part of the world. And I've heard you, to lead it a little bit maybe, I would say I've heard you talk about your love of kind of going for a walk in the woods, and there's that connection.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, if I had kids or if you have kids, teach them the trees, teach them birds, teach them anything about nature. The idea that you can walk out your door and go into the woods. And you know, my father would take us out and go for walks. He grew up in Germany, but he learned the trees. And so that's the part that is a no-brainer for me. I know every tree in this area. And so that's step one, understanding what's around you. And then just, you know, and then applying beyond that, well, what does that mean in terms of what will I find there, you know?
So the gold standard, I think, for a lot of what we talk about foraging, is mushrooms, right? Our mushrooms. And that's what you guys excel in. We started with mushrooms, I think, with you.
Correct.
We've done some amazing, we were just looking at some green walnuts that you brought that we're very interested in. But let's talk a little bit about mushrooms, the kind of mushrooms that we find here in the Mid-Atlantic that you go out for, that you provide to us, that are going to be part of our supper tonight.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in some ways, we're one of the guests tonight is heading to the Northwest, and he's foraging. And out there, you know, and also I think you're collecting in Vermont or New Hampshire. In places like that, and I think elevation may have in part to do with it and more rain in the Northwest, but in some ways we're a very barren area. Sure, we have, you know, there are about 65 mushrooms that we're finding, not every year, not all the time, but based on weather and rain. But actually, when you think about it, we don't have these mega quantities here. You know, it makes it that much more challenging, not only to determine where they're going to grow, but are they even growing? I've walked many acres and miles and never found a mushroom, thinking, it's got to be here. It looks perfect, you know? But so we basically have morels, which most everyone knows. We go into chicken of the woods albino, the Cincinnatus, and then chanterelles. And then, depending on if you go a little bit further north or further west, you get into the boletes, whether it's bicolor, porcini, summer porcinis, and then the black trumpet, hen of the woods, and then maybe oyster. There are many others in here, but those are, like, just generically, those might be the ones that most people will know.
And so when you're walking through the woods, and I know I was going to ask you, like, exactly where you find these, but I have a feeling you're not going to. But what makes you feel like when you're in the woods that you're in the right spot? What are you seeing for mushrooms?
Tom can smell chanterelles in the woods.
So can Spike. I do find myself really focusing on where I am and smells. And yes, it is true. I generally can smell mushrooms. I don't know if it's the actual fruiting body or the mycelia. I'm not sure that mycelia has an odor. But frequently, particularly right now when the water is rushing through the forest, the leaves are disturbed and you'll see the mycelia. It's about, so the trees are the main thing. So the question was, I apologize.
So you're walking through the woods and you're thinking to yourself, where are the mushrooms? This should be a good place for mushrooms.
Got it. Right. And so the first thing is to look at the tree. Absolutely. I mean, so for example, if you're in a pine forest, you know you're not going to see chicken of the woods there. You're not going to see hen of the woods, let's say. But then each mushroom also has a time period that it's going to grow within. These norms are being stretched right now as weather's changing. Uh-huh. We're seeing seasons expanding and some shrinking. Like the morel is almost, I rarely sell the morel. You can't find enough. You know, it's just we're losing it. But it's looking at the tree, the soil, the topography, all factor into a specific
mushroom. You think climate change is impacting morels in this region? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It may also be the amount of Roundup we're using, because I have the sense that that's having an impact, but I'm not 100% sure about that, but I do think that is also contributing.
So this is the longest Jeff has ever been silent. I want to bring him into this conversation. And so at one point you asked me a really a fateful question, which was, would you be interested in truffles? Something to that effect. And that's how I met Jeff. And since then,
actually, my mushrooms were coming here.
Right, I knew that. I found that out in interviews. But so, and that's a really interesting, I think, part of this story is that we were buying mushrooms. Apparently, some of them were Jeff's. And then you asked, would we be interested in truffles? And of course, I'm not interested in truffles from somewhere else. But these truffles are from here.
That's right.
And then I met Jeff.
Local. Local.
Yes,
truffles.
Local truffles. And I still love asking people, have you tried the local truffle? And one of my favorite moments, we had a dinner, or actually a lunch, with some folks from D.C., and in there was, among the group, was Nora Pouillon from Restaurant Nora, amazing chef and culinary kind of icon for this region. And I was able to go over to her table, and we did this very simple pasta dish and shave local truffles. And her, of course, judgment was, they're not as good as Abba, but it was nice. And I was very proud,
though. Not as good as in Austria.
Yes. I was very proud to be able to share that with her in that moment. And I think one of the things that I learned, or, you know, when I got to try your truffles, was that I'm still learning about this region and what it can provide. But it was, so it's an amazing thing for me to be able to share with people. And now for you, I'd love for you to share that story.
Yeah. The specific story?
Yeah.
About how...
The dog? How I want to hear about Esty. Because he's central to it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was my dog's idea to find truffles. What happened was we were out. He was about, I'm guessing a year old at that point. And he was he's an Italian truffle dog, the Lagotto Romagnolo, which is famous for hunting the Italian white truffle and also black and other truffles in Italy and the Adriatic. And we got him from some French winemakers, truffle plantation owners in Burgundy. And the reason they had this breed was that this is the best truffle hunting dog probably available. They, you know, you know what Burgundy wine costs, so they're making a lot of money. They could afford to buy a good dog from Italy, give them a lot of credit, because the French are very ethnocentric, so they actually were willing to bring the first Lagotto Romagnolo into France. We had to put our previous dog down. We loved the breed just for what the dog was in terms of its disposition and appearance and personality and intelligence, and we got to go hunting in truffle plantations in France with this breed of dog, and we decided that's the dog we wanted to have. We had already been sort of lectured that the dog had to be willing to, you had to keep the dog working because the dog's happiest when he's doing stuff. And so we would take him with us when we were at this point it was in West Virginia adjacent to Maryland, and we would take him with us going morel hunting, chanterelle hunting, and at this particular time it was very late July of 2010, and we were looking for porcini with some friends in West Virginia at very high elevation, because that's where you can get the true Boletus sedulis, and it was the time of the year, late July, when they would start to show up. So I took the dog, and my wife went with a couple other friends, and all of a sudden, he's a puppy at this point, essentially, and he scratches the ground and starts eating something, and we know that we were warned by the breeder's friends that you got to watch this dog, will eat anything. So I jumped on the dog, but I got this masticated oog out of his mouth. And he went around his business. We're still walking, looking for truffles. But I said, for porcini. And I said, but I'm watching you. So, and I was watching him and not even looking for the mushroom because I worried about him eating a rock or whatever. The breed's known to do that. And then he scratched and popped in his mouth, and I jumped on him, turned him over, and went into his mouth and pulled out a lump. And it was actually cracked in half, almost in half. And I looked at it, and I said, you could see the gleba, the interior, the maize work. And I said, oh, my God, this is a truffle. Hey, you guys, yelling, come over here. And I smelled it, and I said, wow, that smells really good. It was intense. It was pleasant. It was a little bit of a garlic fest, but I like garlic, so... And I said, I think Esty just found us a truffle. Well, the dog was freaked out for me jumping on him and throwing him back. He was done for the day. But I said, I'm going to read about it when we get back to the cabin. And I read and I said, well, I think I know what this is. This is the yellow furrowed or the great eastern white truffle. We're going to have it over eggs tomorrow morning. And we did. And it was delicious. Really, 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 really good. And, of course, it's fresh.
Yes.
Right? Which is a big thing in the food business, in my opinion, is getting fresh quality is just critical. So that's how it started. The next week, he only got a little bit because I think we had a very limited amount of time to go to the same place. And then 2 weeks later, we went and he dug up almost 2 pounds of this truffle. Now, it turned out to be a really, really good year because we're very cognizant of the rainfall and the weather patterns for regular mushrooms, but I didn't have any idea. I was a rank amateur at that point, and I didn't realize that how important rain was. So there was a very good, consistent summer for rain, and we never got 2 pounds again, but there was a lot of truffles there that year. Yes.
And where was that again?
It was in West Virginia above 3,000 feet.
Okay. Sorry.
And the other thing I could say is there's not a lot of places for this particular truffle to be found, in particular because it turns out that that you need to be in a glacial till area above a certain elevation because the rocks decomposing in the soil raise the pH and make it appropriate for this truffle to fruit and prosper. That's it.
What a moment. I love that story.
Jeff, a question about your dog.
Mm-hmm.
It found truffles without you training it to find truffles, yes?
Actually, I left that up to try to be a little more concise. Is he and his brother, he was in a litter of seven. There were two males. In France, in 2009, all dogs had to be named with an E, so my dog is Esty and his brother is Espresso. And we didn't want an Eddie or Earl. And he and his brother would get up in the morning and they would run out to the garden to do their business. This is in Chambon-Mousonie, if you know your red Burgundy. This is like multi-million dollar ground there. And they would run into the garden and they would do their business and then they would start digging up truffles and eating them. They also were taken out by the winemaker truffle hunter, Bernard Rion, with the older Legotos to go hunting truffle, but that's a different truffle. I mean, it's not, that is a tuber astibium or tuber uncinatum, which is called typically called the Burgundy truffle. And so it's a different truffle, but yes, he did have, you know, the background in theory, but we just didn't have the idea that he would go out and find his own truffle.
And you didn't know that those truffles existed before estate?
Yeah, well, I guess in a very limited sense, in that I had a couple truffle books because I was interested in truffle books, but
you didn't know
so
they
that
were
I could.
Oh,
I just had no idea that they were underfoot. That they were nearby
until Esty found them.
Until exactly correct. And the what I read actually that afternoon when we came home, it was a Saturday. Was it, I had a little book and it talks about tuber canaliculatum, which is the yellow furrowed or great eastern white truffle, and there's a quote in the book about from James Beard saying that the truffle is exquisite. So I felt safe eating it. Like if you can't go by James Beard, who can you go by?
I'll take his.
That's how it happened.
Yes, his opinion is carries a lot of weight around here. Which it's a great way to kind of talk about the next thing I wanted to talk about was knowing what you got. And I think, you know, you even invited some folks to bring some stuff in. I think Teddy pulled some weeds out of the biodiesel lot. But there's what I started with was how much you guys know about what you're looking at, and especially, you know, knowing we've all heard the horror stories, or we know that you know there are poisonous mushrooms, and you've got to know your stuff.
I mean, I think it's really important that you always back off. If you're not sure, you leave it alone. And, you know, that's very important. But I will say, like with anything, once you learn it and know it, you know it. There are some mushrooms that have lookalikes, and you can be fooled, even knowing bicolor is a very good example. But, you know, once you learn it, you tend to know it.
And you have...
Even at this point in time, Tom and I use each other as reference for
different.
We'll send pictures
mushrooms
to each other, or if we're together, say, "Hey, look at this. Here's what I." You agree? And absolutely. And we just it's just always a good idea to be sure of what you're seeing. When mushrooms are like Boletus bicolor, they don't all look exactly alike. It isn't like it's going to be exactly like what you
That's
see
right.
in a textbook.
Weather conditions, the amount of rain.
Yes.
If it got rained on, can completely change the way a mushroom looks.
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about things that aren't mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think mushroom foraging is kind of that gets a lot of the attention, and it's great when you find mushrooms. I think that's kind of that's the holy grail. That's one of the reasons you're out there in the woods. But you find other things, right?
Absolutely.
What are some of your favorite things that you find or that you...
Well, I mean, I think some of the common things that almost anyone will find and is easy, pawpaws, and they can be fantastic.
What is a pawpaw?
So it's a subtropical, you know, plant that can survive in this area. And so it's a tree that likes actually somewhat wet feet. I'll frequently find it in chanterelle areas.
Mm-hmm.
The fruit ripens, you know, August, September. Maybe somewhat mango-like in that zone, mango, banana, not really banana, but has a large seed in it, the native. And, of course, people are now domesticating them and planting forests with them. So, you know, but for me, I always focus on what's native. What I don't want to have anything that's modified. You can do that. I can grow shiitake, I can grow oyster, but I only want to collect out of the wild, you know. So it's not always the best product, but it's native and it's local.
So what else?
Well, pawpaw is obviously an easy one, but, you know, starting with asparagus, I'm still trying to figure the asparagus out. We do have native asparagus. It's super thin. It's thinner than, it's about this thickness. But much of the wild asparagus is actually asparagus that kind of jumped out of the field or wasn't removed when the farmer stopped growing asparagus. So you'll often see it on the edge of fields or in areas, and I'm still doing some research on this, but, you know, when we were moving with ships, ship captains, I think, were planting things in different places if they knew they were coming back annually or whatever, so they knew they would have some food there in the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of that comes about because of that. Also, the American Indians are moving things, like the prickly pear.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably has been pulled from further south.
Mm-hmm.
Walnuts may be pushed further west. So they, I think they were moving things, but you know, cedar tips or the tips of the spruce is something that's nice to eat. Gosh, there's so many things, and just continually expanding, like the example of the yarrow.
How about the we have a small amount that we've incorporated into our supper tonight, which is the cactus.
The cactus.
So you got to talk about Maryland cactus.
Did you know about that?
Well, basically, it's the eastern prickly pear. I have a site. I grew up in Fort Washington, which is an area actually where the settlers kind of first came to meet the Piscataway Indians. And the Piscataway Indians wanted them to stay in this Accokeek, Fort Washington area because they were fighting with Iroquoian tribes. And they thought, well, if the settlers are here, they'll stop bothering us and they'll bother the white folks. And so they ultimately ended up going back to St. Clemens Island. But I have this large cactus patch that I think goes back to that time period.
So that was introduced from somewhere else? Or how does that
No, it's native.
Up?
It's native.
So why is it there then?
Well, if you walk enough, you'll find it. You'll find it almost. I don't know how far up it'll go, but certainly in Maryland and further south, you're going to see this cactus. And you know, the cactus, you can pretty much just take the pad, throw it in the ground, it'll sprout roots and grow. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy from that perspective. But I just, you know, one day I was walking and I found this patch.
Any other fruits?
Persimmon. And persimmons are a very important one because many of the trees are dying out. We've started to plant them, you know, at roadside. So persimmon and then wild plums are the three main fruits. But, of course, you've got wild cherries. That's already finished. You've got the serviceberry. That's a little bit harder to find. And then the other issue is a lot of the trees are taller. You know, they're competing. Mm-hmm. And so how do you get up there to get the fruit? And that's one of the issues with the walnut, because some of these trees are 80 feet tall. There's no way I'm going to get up there, you know, so I have to kind of pick at the edges.
How about mulberry?
Mulberry, again, was introduced, so it's not technically native. It was introduced to do silk. Mm-hmm. It didn't work out exactly the way they thought, but you'll come across, you know, both black and white mulberries. I think the white is much better. I lost a large white mulberry tree, so I haven't found a new one yet. Mulberries are very influenced by rain. If there's too much rain, they lose their flavor, I think. Mm-hmm. But certainly the mulberry is just finishing right now. You'll see the dirt on the asphalt as you're driving down the road. It's usually a mulberry. Later it's persimmon. In the fall it's persimmon when you see the same fleck. And then many herbs. There are two types of mint, mountain mint, and that are native. There's a basil that's actually native. I'm working on that right now to see what it tastes like fully grown. I just tried it as a micro. And it just goes on. So, you know, it's something where I'm just learning. I'm kind of expanding in this area and relying on chefs to say, hey, can you get me X?
How about wineberries? You guys...
Wineberries are getting ready. They're still closed. Uh-huh. I was just looking at thousands of them. Again, it's a fragile thing. If we get a lot of rain, then you lose a bunch. Last year was another invasive,
right?
Right, and so let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So in terms of invasives, they're fantastic. I mentioned this earlier, to harvest those because you're reducing its spread. And the weird thing is that somehow a deer and our local animals are smarter than we are. They know, hey, this is introduced. This is not native. I'm not going to eat it. And that's the problem with invasives. They won't touch them, and so they spread like wildfire. And so that's why it's just so great to eat those invasives. And when chefs understand that and put them on the menu, it's a great win-win.
Anything you bother with that's not a mushroom out there in the woods, or are you just
truffles?
Yeah, well, okay. I think that's
the fungi.
Technically, yeah.
Tom periodically asked me, because sometimes we're journeying into the same, we're foraging in similar areas at different times of the week or the month, and he will ask me occasionally to harvest stuff, and I'm a pretty cooperative guy, so I did a bunch of autumn olive
a
couple years ago, and that was
invasive.
that was.
But used generally as a plant. They were planting it all over Montgomery County.
Yeah. I had an.
In cooking.
You can use it. You can make a juice from it. You can make a ketchup or a jelly.
I had an unsuspecting friend or relative with me, and said, "We got to make a little stop here."
It happens all the time.
I had some old sheets in the back of the car we use for painting, and I drop cloths, if you will, and I put it around the tree. And
no, that was actually an apple.
That was Spike bought.
It was a Russian apple.
Oh, that was a Russian apple.
I found well, it's probably not native, but it's a tree, apple tree, and they're very small fruit and.
Tom, it's really great to walk through the woods with Tom, because even we enjoy walking the woods anyway, and that's really, if you really want to learn how to find some fungi for you to eat, having the joy of walking through the woods and enjoying it just for what it is important. But walking with Tom is always interesting, because it could even be the worst time of the year for anything going on, and there's always things for him to talk to me about and tell me, you know, we got to remember to come back here in 6 weeks, because this is going to fruit, and it's really great.
How about spice bush? Have you had much? You mentioned that earlier.
Sure. So the spice bush is great because you can use the leaf for tea. Deer hate it, so if you put a spice bush somewhere in the yard, you can probably fend off some deer. But then it has a berry, and we've been experimenting with the berry. In fact, I was at a Rake's Progress last night, and Opie let me try the dried spice bush. So we took a bunch of chefs and went out and collected the berries, and I think you dried them. Did you keep both sections? Because there's an inner and an outer.
Right, we did a number of different versions, some of which had both, some of which we separated. Because I think the seed is a little bitter. And
got it.
It's one of the few things that I've ever encountered in my life that has actual kind of black pepper aromatics.
Mm-hmm. Right,
just
I
kind
agree.
Of the holy.
And I was tasting pork when I had that in my mouth. But the spice bush is actually, it brings up one of the things, just like I sent some blueberries up as well, some of these things take a long time to collect. And you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? But you do it for the love of it. You love the idea that you've learned the plant, and you find the plant, and then you harvest it. And it's just it's a great thing.
But why you're doing this sort of involves, why are you doing this if I'm supposed to be out here on a commercial level? Certainly for yourself and for your own personal consumption, it's more of a reasonable prospect.
Right, for sure.
Well, quick interruption.
What about ramps?
So, again, ramps. It's interesting because, ramps were pervasive. They were everywhere. That's a wild leek. If you eat at Woodbury, you've probably had them. And there are still some, fairly close to Baltimore, fairly close to D.C., but during the Depression, and I have, I should have brought it tonight, I have a Wild Mushroom magazine, or Nature magazine, has an article about, hey, people are coming to your door selling mushrooms. You need to know what you're buying. So during the Depression, particularly in these very heavily populated areas, this is somewhat supposition, but also I think this is what's going on, people basically, to survive, they would forage. And so that's how we lost ramps in areas like this, in suburban areas and city areas. But also...
Because of over...
It was over-harvested. It was, gone. Mushrooms obviously would come back. They couldn't kill the mycelia. But again, this idea that you did whatever you could to survive. But the point about ramps is that ramps tend to grow in mountainous areas further out. That's where they're left. But again, it's one of these things where you have to treat it fairly. You can't just go in and dig all of the ramps. You have to leave them in patches. You take small portions. And so that's the other part of foraging. You need to think about, well, should I take all of these chanterelles or leave some behind? And so those are some of the thoughts that go on in your head when you're walking for hours and you don't find a chanterelle, and then you come across a new patch. Hey, what's the best way? What's the most sustainable way? Certainly, I want to come back and do this again next year. I don't want this mushroom to be gone. And you think about that as well with animals, actually, like deer. Deer will wipe out plants. And you wonder, what are they not getting? You know, because, I mean, this may seem kind of odd, but you would think that Mother Nature would have it set up where they wouldn't wipe something out. They would just take part of it. But animals will wipe out things. But as a human, I really kind of think about, hey, I don't want to ruin this resource. I want it to be there, but I also want a chef to enjoy it and serve it to a customer.
Tom is, he's beginning to say this, but he now is expanding the idea of ramps. He's expanded it to ramp shoots starting in the late winter, very, very early spring. He's doing ramps during the regular season, and they go, I guess, for a month or 6 weeks. But he's also now has done ramp bulbs, which is the leaf of the wild leek dies off or becomes yellow, discolored. It's done its business. And he goes out and he'll dig ramp bulbs. And
Opie did not like them.
I will say that your ramp shoots, though, gave us hope through a long, wet kind of end of winter, early spring, and it was the first thing that we'd seen that was fresh and new and gave us hope that spring and summer were on the way. So we appreciate those.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about, before we take some questions, I've been in the woods with you guys, and one of the qualities that I lack, that you guys clearly have, and one of the things that's I think crucial for a good forager is your awareness. And I want to try to get you to talk about it, because it's so when I was out with you and you would say, like, I think there could be chanterelles here, and all of a sudden all I could think about, all I could look for, all I would probably see was chanterelles. And you don't have that. I mean, you're seeing the whole forest, which, if you think about it,
we also found a chicken up in a tree.
Well, I was going to get there. And you know, I was out with my son, and we were out in Western Maryland, and we were finding chanterelles, and then he found black trumpets, which I thought was the coolest thing. And
He was good.
That, because those are next to impossible
really
to see.
Really hard to see.
And we were like standing there, and he was like, "Oh, black trumpets!" And I was just like, oh, "I didn't see those. You did. That was amazing." And then there was that. Your example was we were out looking for chanterelles, and of course my eyes are glued to the forest floor, and we'd found some, which was, you know, that's why I was so. And then you're like, "Oh, there's," I mean, that mushroom was 30 feet in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about what that's. This is like a superpower, or something that I want somebody to describe to me, because I don't, you know, and I could be. I don't know, but it's something that I was.
Well,
I was,
you know, I think it's like anything. As you start to focus, you know, Nancy hates to drive with me, and in fact, I was being accused today of not looking at the road because I was looking at. There was an elderberry bush that was, I've never seen anything this big. It was on the BW Parkway. You can't stop there. But, I mean, it was just massive.
Where was that exactly?
It was massive. And, but I think, you know, what's going on is that you just the idea of, you know, just being so attuned to to your surroundings,
right.
You know, and so, but part of it too is that, you know, I may not have noticed that chicken, you know, 10 years ago because I wasn't really looking for a chicken. So I think over time, as you walk many, many miles, you start to, you know, things start to have patterns, you know, and so that's where, and it's interesting because the oak trees are dying out. You know, I don't know how much longer they're going to be here. It'll mean a lot of chicken and a lot of hen, but, you know, I was walking today.
And
I managed
they'll be dead. Explain that.
There's a blight going on.
Right.
And so they're just systematically dying out. I don't
and
fully
understand. Chicken and hen?
Oh, so right. During the death of the tree. So this is actually something for landscape architecture. If you see a chicken mushroom or a hen of the woods in your yard, next to the tree, you know you've only got a number of years and that tree is going to be gone. It's going to be dead. Okay, so certain mushrooms indicate the death of a tree. Other mushrooms indicate a symbiotic relationship. And then it's slightly different, but the hericium, there's a white ball that looks like a you know,
pom-pom or
like a pom-pom, I guess, with hair. The hair grows. That tree's that mushroom's actually cleaning out the wound of a tree. So they all mean different things, but oaks are on the way out, and it's kind of sad.
I have really a little bit different perspective than Tom about going into the woods. And first of all, he knows trees like few people do. And for me, my approach to mushroom hunting, and I was hunting far more than morels for 30 years, my approach has always been, what time of the year is it? What should I potentially be seeing? And I think it's an advantage and a disadvantage, because my focus is a little narrower than what Tom has when he goes in the woods. So right now, when we're on the cusp of chanterelles have started, some of us are finding black trumpets, some of us are not. But where we're on the cusp of the season, Tom is going to find the unusual stuff now, whereas me, I went out for my really the first time looking for chanterelles today. I did this morning because I knew a patch that I could get to in a reasonable amount of time was likely to be coming in, because it usually comes in between.
But you also have dates in your head, right?
Well, I know it's between the 17th and 22nd of June. Today's the 21st. Let's go out there and I usually would expect to get half a pound to a pound, and I got 4.5 pounds.
And that was some of those were out on the
yes,
table.
And they're on display.
Uh-huh.
And it's Cantharellus latiricus, the smooth chanterelle. But I knew what I'm supposed to be seeing, but I also know what else could be on the ground at that time that would also be a edible or choice wild edible. So, but I'm not going to see Tom. You found something.
But I found them about 2.5-3 weeks ago. They started.
Yeah, but he's also willing to look at little nubs and pick about 17 of them and walk for 15 hours to do that. And I'm a little more focused with what I'm doing, because I have to keep my dog interested in other stuff. But you found something.
The umbrella polypore.
Umbrella polypore, and it's really a little bit out of season. But see, he finds it because he's got more of an open attitude about what he's going to find in the woods. Whereas me, I know, you know, I'm going to be finding some of the early boletes, non-porcini boletes. I may find some oyster mushroom on the media is the tree rather than the ground. Other kind of ground mushroom that might come at the same time as chanterelles, but it's a different, it's a little bit different way to look at it. And so when people come, I take out people to go mushroom hunting, friends and friends of friends, and they'll say, well, how are we going to go about doing this? And I say, here's what we should be seeing. And that really helps them to focus. And then I'll find an example of it, and then I'll say, stare at it. Really, stare at it. Get a mental image. And now start walking. The next thing you know, they're finding the mushrooms that I would be finding. So it's a little bit more of a focused idea. But if you're going to go out there, you know, doing a little reading, doing a little research ahead of time to find out what should be there is probably going to help you, particularly if you're not that experienced.
Or come to dinner at Woodbury, see what's on the menu, and then you know what's out there.
With all this knowledge here at this table on either side of me, we should really open this conversation. I'm sure that there are some questions.
I don't think the ladies who rode with us should be allowed to ask any questions.
We'll see.
Hey, I was just wondering, are there natural barriers set up to prevent domesticating all those plants that you were just speaking about? Like, why can't you grow, you know, truffles in your backyard next to your pawpaw tree and stuff like that?
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of science behind. I mean, you pick truffles in particular, and Jeff has a lot more knowledge about that. But mushrooms in general, the handful that you go to the farmer's market and see that are technically wild but are domesticated, they figured out. The others are too complicated. There's too much going on. And so the relationship with the soil, the plant, the minerals, you know, chanterelle is one they just can't do. So the barrier is, you know, ultimately will we figure it out? I don't know. But I think that to me also is why I love to, when I say forage, you know, for the thing that's growing wild outside, not what I can force or what I can, you know, tend to make grow. Because it's that challenge to find it. But I think also because it's growing there, it's going to have fantastic flavor. It's going to, I try to deliver within a day or two so that the nutrient value isn't at a loss. So there are barriers, yes.
But that's part of the allure then, too.
Absolutely.
Something that hasn't been figured out, and it's out there, and
absolutely,
you'll get it.
You want me to respond about truffles?
Yes.
The truffles like very high pH soil, and at least in this part of the country, there's not so many of those places where the pH is high enough that you're going to see a lot of...
Seven.
It's got to be probably at seven or a little bit higher, 7.2. So there's really, on the East Coast of the United States, there's not that many places where the pH gets that high where the associated trees that you would find with, for instance, the tuber canaliculatum, where they're in the same place, and also elevation is a factor. So that, now that said, my dog, what he does is he exposes the truffle to me, and as part, he digs. Lagotto Romagnolos have webbed feet. It was, they were their water dog. That's what they used to be in Italy before they drained the lakes. So, but he scratches the soil until he exposes the truffle, but he gets little pieces of the truffle under his claws, and I take him, drive an hour or two back to my cabin. He digs out in the yard. We now have the truffle in the yard around the cabin because he's digging in the yard and he's planting the spores. That, but we are also, the cabin is at like 3,000 feet, so, and there's, we're on the side of a sort of a mountain, so we have enough, high enough pH that it could happen there, but he's not going to come to Loch Raven Reservoir and go dig around there with his truffly paws and get truffles to grow there.
Can you talk a bit about the sorts of places that you're doing the foraging? Is it national?
So,
well, not necessarily specifically, but
no,
forests private land?
Right.
Sort of thing.
Generally speaking, private land, most parts.
With permission?
Well, no, of course. Yeah. There is your drive-by, mm-hmm. right? So the rule there is knock on the door. If no one's home, you take it.
That's our ethic.
I say this in jest. So
that's not true.
Generally private. The problem.
Do you actually knock on the door, or do you?
Oh,
no, I'll knock.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Although I've been in situations where I was really sketchy about knocking, but anyway, in the problem with parks is that generally speaking, you can't. Well, first of all, you can't run a business out of a park, so that's off limits. Most parks do not let you do any, you know, if you go to mycological associations where they do forays in their parks, typically they'll tell you, hey, you can't collect here, you know. So it's more private and.
But people are very amenable to, if they find out you're interested in seeing mushrooms in their
They almost always
area,
say take it. Almost
they said,
always.
Really? Sure, help yourself. Knock
they
yourself
never
out.
Want to eat it. They never want to eat
the
it.
The funny thing is, actually, is they sort of are a little bit more concerned that you know what you're doing because they don't want somebody dropping over in their front yard or their back 40. So you asking permission is not a big deal. The part about it that I don't like is I'm a little bit compulsive, so I'm like on the clock. I want to get out there, get my product. I want to enjoy the process. I don't particularly... One of the parts I like about walking in the woods is I don't have to talk to anybody else. But if I'm knocking on their door, next thing you know, they got me in a jabber fest for 10 or 15 minutes. And all I really want to do is go pick their chicken in the woods on the tree nearby or the hen in the woods on the ground by
what,
their
What do you tell
tree.
People your wife does with the mushrooms?
I've been known to maybe not tell exactly what happens with the mushroom. I have a tie-dye story. We used to had a friend who's probably passed on to the better things. But she actually collected mushrooms from tie-dyeing T-shirts. And that was a story I used for a while, saying. And also, if I really thought it was in an area where they're going to be highly suspicious of me being there, I would have a camera. And I would say, or sometimes I'm harvesting an area where it is, there are other people that have access to the same private land and we're in competition. But also they may be riding a mountain bike through or whatever. I used to have a camera so that I would have it around my neck, and I'd say, and they would say, "What are you doing?" And I'd say, "Taking pictures of wildflowers," which was really not what was happening. Tom is probably more straightforward than me about that.
If you're foraging for mushrooms and you have small children, by all means, take them. Tom has had my grandchildren spotting mushrooms from the age of 2.5.
And my dog, Esty, was out with me this morning, and he showed me where the next chanterelles were. He would actually get up and walk over 20, 30 paces and sit back down, and I would walk over there, and there were a little bit of chanterelles right there. And he's only 9 years old.
Neither of you mentioned lobster mushrooms. Are there lobsters in the region?
Not many.
It's too bad.
You have to go to higher elevation. They're very limited, I think. What do you find? Maybe a pound a year, something like
that?
Yeah,
in western Maryland, I usually get a pound or two a year. If I really get lucky, I might get a pound and a half.
What is a lobster mushroom?
It's a hypomycized mushroom, which means there is a mushroom that is growing over another mushroom.
Typically Russula, right?
Typically Russula mushroom that is, there's this secondary mushroom growing over it and transforming the mushroom into a lobster mushroom. And it actually, unlike the Russula, now the mushroom becomes firm, it draws moisture out of it, and it coats it with this lobster colored
Can it happen to an Amanita?
Well, here's what I've always been taught, and of course I'm picking in the same places pretty much, but you need to see what is in the area. If I found a lobster mushroom, I need to know what other mushroom, because it doesn't hypomycize every mushroom in that area.
What does that word mean?
It means some of the mushrooms have the secondary fungus grow over them, and some of the mushrooms stay uninfected. So I'm looking to see what else is there. And if I'm seeing just regular Russula mushrooms, you can look it on Google, mushroomexpert.com, whatever. That's an easy lookup. If I see that, then I have no qualms whatsoever about picking it. There are some mushrooms that I harvest and Tom harvests where we have poisonous, toxic Amanita mushrooms growing in the same place that we might find the horse mushroom, Agaricus arvensis. So I don't even try to really teach other people that mushroom. I know it because of, you know, some properties about what, when you touch it, when you smell it, whatever. But that's a common one where you got bad mushrooms growing right near it.
Yeah.
I do believe that the hypomycosis occurs on all sorts of mushrooms. It does occur on gilled mushrooms like Amanita. So you have to know what you're doing. New England's a great place for collecting Maine lobster mushroom. And I was up in Maine one time, and I was in an area where I was collecting huge quantities of golden chanterelles. Spike can't have them because they're too far away. They're not local, but really, it's like picking the mushrooms in Europe. It's just gorgeous. And I walked in there, and all of a sudden, I saw this orange light across, you know, 100, 200 yards away. And I walked toward it, and the sun was shining on a lobster mushroom, and it was like a pound and a half. And I got like two, three, 4 pounds, just boom, like that. But again, that's higher elevation, lots of pine trees, you know, and the soil is more conducive to that mushroom occurring.
I have two questions. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
My first question is...
So I have two questions. The first question for you, for the three of you, is how in the world did you get into this field? The second question is, if you were to, in the future, as you grow older, how is there another field that you might transfer your skills to, aside from seeking out mushrooms and truffles? Those are my two questions.
I'll answer.
And I also wanted to note that my two takeaways from what you said, the gentleman on my right, the joy of walking through the woods, we've all shared, but we approach the woods in different perspectives.
Yeah. I have friends who that's about the last thing on earth that they would really want to do. They're perfectly happy to eat the mushrooms that I will cook for them. They're perfectly happy for me to give them so that they can cook them, but they want nothing to do with walking in the woods.
So my question is, how did you get into this field, and secondly, where might you go next?
I'll answer your first question because I think I have a little bit more of it, maybe an interesting story. I'm a retired attorney, primarily real estate. I'm now retired, but I wasn't when I started mushroom hunting. I'm now 66. I started when I was 36, maybe 35. And what happened was I was working a lot and very, very stressed out from practicing law. And my wife, part frustration, but part also she likes to cook, and she says, why not? She said, here's a cutout from the Washington Post sports section about morels. Why don't you go find us some morels? The article was from the 1981. There was a guy by the name of Angus Phillips, famous columnist at the Washington Post for many, many years. Outdoorsman is what it used to be called. And so I took the article with me, and I went to the Audubon Society in Chevy Chase, Maryland. I lived in Silver Spring, different parts of Silver Spring at that point, but it's like 20 minutes from my house. I went in there, read a book for an hour. I went across the road from the Audubon Society, and in about 20 minutes I had 8 giant Morchella crassipes mushrooms that I had collected. Pure, blind, dumb luck. And so I just looked up a name in the article, looked him up in the phone book. It's 1987 at this point. And you couldn't Google him on the internet. And I went to his house. And he was a member of the Mycological Association of Washington. And the last thing he said to me after he gave me a French Opinel mushroom knife as just a gift for just because I guess he thought I was strange. is he said, you really should consider joining the Mycological Association, then you can get a lot of help with identification. So that's how it happened for me.
Basically, you know, catering is kind of a burnout business, and I love being in the woods walking, and so had focused on morels since I learned mushrooms from someone from Holland back in the late 80s, and actually went after culinary school. I went to the mom meetings, met Jeff and Barbara, and just focused on morels. Around 2012, I went to a party where Jeff was, and Jeff said, "Tom, why don't you sell the mushrooms?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, you know, sell them to restaurants. And basically, because he prompted me to do that, that's how I got into this full time.
He was collecting enough that he, you know, and plus it's a product that when people know what they're doing, the quality of what generally is being provided is nothing that you can order in from another part of the U.S. or the world. We hear this from the chefs that we provide for a lot, saying, you know, the best part is we're getting it like day two, day one, day three, and it's just a quality we can't get.
And what I would do afterwards, actually I'm contemplating, but I wouldn't do this right away, going back to graduate school and work on mycology degree.
And I'm not a forager, but I would say as a chef who does appreciate what these guys do and has a connection to our food system here, I want Woodbury to be as complete a representation of what this region can produce as possible, and these guys have helped me understand that a lot of what that is doesn't come from agriculture, and that was a revelation to me and helped, you know, again, I think part of what foraging does is help kind of open you up to what's out there, what's possible, and that's what it's meant to me, and it's also meant that we have a number of delicious things on our menu at various parts of the year that we wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah.
But Woodbury Kitchen is also very open-minded about trying things. I mean, there's some chefs that, and I've been at this with chefs since 1993. There's some chefs relatively closed-minded. And it may be because they don't have the flexibility to be changing their menu or what have you. They don't feel comfortable in running a special. They're just not. They only want chanterelles. They want morels, and that's all they want. And we're out there foraging because we think there are a lot of great choice wild edible mushrooms, a number of them. And when Tom says picking, I did a count one time, and I've sold over 84, 85 different kinds of wild edible mushrooms. And I think 65 is probably a good indication of how much we could end up selling in a year of different mushrooms. But they're good mushrooms. I mean, it's really a testament to the chefs that we've decided to work with, because they're really creative and they really care about, you know, what the mushroom is going to end up on the plate. It's not just to say there's wild mushroom in it. I mean, it's, you end up with a great dish.
One of the, probably along with sustainable seafood, one of the most abused terms, you know, when you see wild mushroom on a menu, you should probably,
absolutely,
you should probably run the other way. But anyway, not in this case.
Ask him what wild mushroom,
yes,
is it?
Oh, it's shiitakes
and portobello.
Yes.
How do you know when you might be over harvesting a certain mushroom or plant? Is there something that you worry about?
Well, you know, one of the thoughts about mushrooms is that, to compare it to an apple tree, the tree in the mushroom world would be the mycelia, which is underground, and then it puts out its fruit, which, you know, like the apple. So to a certain extent, that mycelia you're not really hurting by taking its fruit. However, certain mushrooms need that spore to go on to make new mycelia, because that mycelia may not survive for an extended time period. In other cases, you just want to have more production. You want more in future years. So I think, you know, if you have a site that you regularly go to, that's where you then over the years start to realize, hey, wait a second. By, you know, I can affect what's going on either in a negative way or in a positive way. So it's, and every mushroom is different.
I can respond to that a little more specifically. Chanterelle mushrooms are brittle when you harvest them, particularly the smooth chanterelle, Cantharellus latericus. As the golden chanterelle is a little less brittle, but the chanterelle mushroom, the smooth chanterelle, which is primarily what we have in this area, is very reproductive. I mean, it just, when those little pieces break off, that is reseeding everything that's going on. Truffles, when my dog digs truffles, he's scraping the truffle spore off the truffle. Literally, there's a carve mark in it. I had to explain to Spike what he was seeing. That I didn't just take a sample off of his truffle. That was my dog who did the scrape. he's reintroducing the spores in that environment. I'm getting more truffles now, if the weather cooperates, than I did 7 years ago, 8 years ago. But there's other mushrooms that are definitely, you know, at risk, and it is probably pretty easy to go into a morel site and to harvest too many morels, and morels need to shoot off some spores. It's an ascomycete. It's a spore shooter. So I'm particularly careful to make sure we don't try to take every morel. And if there's one that's a little too old or if there were little or very, very young, I leave the little guy. I mean, how big is it anyway? Just leave it behind. Let it do its business and let it reseed the ground. I don't worry about tree mushrooms pretty much. Like oyster mushrooms, they're prolific enough. Chicken of the woods is prolific enough that they're going to spread their spores anyway and get the job done. So, but back to the truffle. Raking truffle is a real common phenomenon. It was actually done quite a bit in Europe, and even in the west coast of the United States, Oregon and Washington, they were raking truffles. And what you're doing there, rather than having a dog like mine who's dog harvesting, meaning he's only taking the ripe truffle, they're raking the ground and pulling everything out. And as a result, like where the people that were the breeders for our dog formed the Burgundy Truffle Society, I know it's a confraternity is what they call it. Like, you know, in French, it sounds good. But they formed it because there were too many people raking, and their whole premise is that you had to have a dog, and you take the dog out, and you collect the Burgundy truffles. And they really also were willing to share a lot of information so that you could have a dog or, you know, whatever, so to stop people from raking. So now there's more truffles in Burgundy than ever because you're doing it the right way. Does that help you with an answer?
Is this the last question?
Can I have two?
Sure.
First question is, do you have any recommendations for books for foraging mushrooms or other wild edibles? The second question is, when you knock on somebody's door and there's a beautiful chicken of the woods in the front, how do you know they haven't sprayed their lawn? And that, things like that.
That's a very good point. And I think the way that you know that is by looking at the grass. In other words, if it's a beautiful lawn, you know they're spraying. And if it's got weeds and clover, and then you know
moss,
that they're
moss.
Not. And moss. I mean, that's typically, yeah.
If it looks like it's not maintained, then I would feel safe in dealing with a lawn like that. But really, you don't see... Outside of horse mushroom, you might see Agaricus arvensis in real lot of turf. But you look at, you know, where you're at.
But it's an indication of what's going on. Usually you have a good sense, I think. When
any
you see
books
it.
To...
I do.
Yeah.
There is a gentleman from West Virginia called Bill Rudy, William C. Rudy, I believe. And he's written a book about the... wild mushrooms of the mid-Atlantic and the Appalachians, something like that. I own the book. I don't remember the exact title. But you can buy it on Amazon paperback for about $12. Bill Rudy, I know the guy. It's a much better than average mushroom book, and it deals with our area. So really, like, local. It's local to us, essentially. So I really think you couldn't go wrong by getting Bill Rudy's book. Tom, do you have...
I agree. Just in terms of reading about the stories of mushroom foragers, et cetera, a number have come out recently. But I think, you know, one that's of interest that goes beyond just identifying the actual mushroom, which you need, Mycelia Running is, I think, still a good book to, you know, to get a general background on just the whole world of mycelia.
Right. By the way, Rudy is spelled R-O-O-D-Y.
One quick last question from my friend here. Are any of your mushrooms available for retail?
No. I mean, they can be made available retail, but there's not enough. It's mainly going to restaurants. If you're in the D.C. area, you can go to the DuPont Farmers Market. I forget the chef's. He's a chef, but he's one of the first farmers to start this whole from St. Mary's County. Do you remember his name? Anyway, he's at the DuPont, and he forages as well. But you'll pay double because he's selling by volume.
We can't get enough mushrooms for chefs like Spike, Opie Crooks at Reg's Progress, other good chefs in Baltimore and D.C. And truffles, that'll never happen because they just don't get enough of them to...
Don't even think about it.
Yeah. If I've got extra truffles, I know who wants them.
So I want to end this with a quick... Your best, you mentioned stories. What is your best haul ever? What was the best moment you ever had in the woods where you what was that moment like?
Well, I was like 3 weeks in, and I had a friend who used to mushroom with me a lot, a mutual friend of Tom and mine named Don. He happened to be along on that second or third week after Esty found his first truffle, and getting almost 2 pounds of truffles, and he was a puppy at that point. He didn't have the stamina he does now. We found a nest of truffles, and some of them were like almost like tennis balls. They were certainly golf balls, and there was like a nest of them. And I was just thrilled.
Giddy?
I mean, I was just completely giddy.
I think maybe...
Best moment ever.
I think maybe goes back to what we refer to as a school bus, which means, an oak tree that's just loaded with chicken of the woods, sulfur, going all the way up.
So bright yellow.
Bright yellow stop for the school
bus. School bus in the woods.
and harvest. I mean, you know, you can pull hundreds of pounds, which you probably have.
You know, we spend a lot of time in the woods not finding anything. So I know some chefs, and they probably think, why am I paying this much a pound for this one? The guy walked up and he just hacked off 30 pounds of mushroom, because we spent a lot of time not finding anything. That's for you, Spike.
Thank you. It is so appreciated, and I want to thank you guys, yes, for being here.
Thanks again for joining us tonight for our conversation at Artifact Coffee. With special thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Donnie Carlo for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you to them for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.